Mother, it's quite inappropriate to
ask. Yes, you do seem to be having difficulty. A man your age must work to keep himself in shape.
Mother, I'm not going another step like this. A starship has its customs just as we do. If you're my mother's valet, then please valet.
Oh, please don't let me keep you from doing your duty.
I apologize for her behavior. Do you realize you've embarrassed your captain?
Oh, no.
Oh, anything to avoid a quarrel on this occasion.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, getting a face transported to me that's going to make some weird jewelry all of a sudden. Yeah, that's me.
This is a reach.
Yeah.
I can only wonder what this has to do with this week's conundrum.
Well, maybe we'll find out a little bit more in just a moment, Cam.
And we are celebrating Mother's Day this week with a special episode entitled Mother's Gone Amok.
Oh, I get that. Very clever, Cameron.
I know.
Well, what does this actually mean, though? What are we diving into, Cam?
Well, was it about a year ago we did an issue called Star Trek's Daddy Issues, where it was
Father's Day, so it would have been a little less than a year ago.
That's right. Yeah,
Father's Day is in June, sir.
Yeah. Good
Somebody point. Obviously doesn't care about his parents.
I really don't.
No,
but like many of the characters on Star Trek,
that's true.
But you know, we talked a lot about daddy issues in all the series, and there was a lot. Like, so many characters had very prominent father characters. Really interesting going through mothers, that how many of them had unnamed mothers.
Memory Alpha, what a revelation there. Just discovering Star Trek doesn't really seem to care nearly as much about mothers and the role that mothers play as they do with fathers and those daddy issues. I'm looking at you, Kyle Riker, right now. But, you know, fascinating stuff here.
Yeah, so let's just dive into the original series. There's not a lot to talk about because most of the characters didn't really even reference their mothers. Kirk, you got a little bit. But Spock is the one that people think of when they think of mothers. Here's the question. When we look at Amanda in the Prime Universe, was there a lot of motherly issues with Spock, or did it all really center around Sarek?
I think it all centered around Sarek, and we dive deep into that in our Daddy's Issue episode. But with Amanda, I feel bad for her in that she, when we get to the end of Journey to Babel, and Sarek and Spock are both just being their very troublesome selves. I don't you feel bad that Amanda had to experience this, you know, raising Spock in such a household where, as a human woman, it must have been incredibly frustrating?
Well, not only that, but her son has turned against her half.
Yeah.
Like, she is the human half of this equation.
She loves him.
Yes.
Does Spock love his mother?
That's an excellent question.
Is he suppressing love for his mother?
It seems like it, because everything about her that she would give to him, he really refuses to give back to her. And, you know, Journey to Babel, we don't get a lot of that. It centers so much on Sarek. But when we get into the movies, you know, we see more, like, I think it's Star Trek IV, we see, you know, her saying, you know, Spock, how do you feel? How do you feel? And, you know, the big breakthrough is him saying, I feel fine. I mean, whoop-de-doo. Well, throw the parade for Amanda.
I think Amanda must be used to responses like that from her son.
How does she do it? Because this is something I've actually thought about a lot this week when when I was doing research for this episode. Does the Amanda-Sarek relationship, does it even make sense to you? Like, what is Amanda getting out of this?
It's interesting. The thing that people don't really maybe want to think about is that Amanda could just be a big weirdo.
Right.
Like, she could just be a strange person who never really fit in on Earth, you know. So she goes and she takes a liking to Vulcans. She moves there and, Sarek was he at one time an ambassador to Earth?
I believe he was, yeah.
Yeah, so that's how he met Amanda, right?
Right, yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe she could, you know, find something in him that she realizes, you know, this man's never going to love me, even though I love him. But I think that there's just something so instinctual, you know, about a mother's love for a child, and for that to not be reciprocated, or else, like, maybe the son goes through many years where he's expressing these emotions, which are looked down upon in society.
Mm-hmm.
That must be incredibly difficult for Amanda to deal with. I don't know how, like, I literally don't know how she does that and seems like a sane human being as she does in Journey to Babel and Star Trek IV.
Well, and she, you know, as played by Jane Wyatt, she's endlessly pleasant.
Yeah.
She's never someone who we really get a sense of inner turmoil or frustration. You know, maybe a little bit of frustration with the Spock-Sarek fight.
Yeah.
But we never get the sense, like, this poor woman is just like, God, you know, even my son can't embrace that which I give to him.
So, Cam, I pose this question to you. Does Spock love his mom? And maybe we don't know the answer in the Prime universe, but I think if we jump over to the Kelvin universe and we look at the first Star Trek film, the 2009 J.J. Abrams debut, I think it's very clear to me that Spock in the Kelvin universe does in fact love Amanda. Like, her death, when we see the destruction of Vulcan by Nero, it's very clear that it affects him. It makes his emotions boil to the top.
Right. Well, I mean, Nimoy talked a lot, first off, about how when he played Spock, he played a guy who felt constant emotions and had to fight to keep them. So does he love his mother? I think so. I think it's he has to hide them.
Right.
And we've seen, you know, he explodes when he finds out Jim is alive in a mock time, right? So I have to believe there's a similar quality towards his mother. Yeah, I think that's made a lot more apparent in the J.J. Abrams movie because, you know, you have that scene where, you know, Uhura goes to comfort Spock, you know, in the transporter room. And I think this might be maybe my favorite moment of Zachary Quinto's Spock performances out of all three films.
Yeah.
Is, you know, her trying to comfort him, and he's, you can tell that he's holding it back. He's still got that Spock-like reserve, but you can tell that this really is eating him up in a big way.
Okay. When you heard that Amanda Greystone, or not
Grayson,
Amanda,
yeah.
Amanda Grayson, was going to be coming into this particular universe, I mean, were you all that familiar with her when you went and saw the first film back in 2009?
I believe, well, I would have seen all the TOS movies, and I can't remember if I'd gotten to Journey. I don't think I'd gotten to Journey to Babel yet.
Well, what I'm getting at, I guess, is she's very much a fully fleshed out character in the 2009 film.
Right.
And she's not at all that really in Journey to Babel or Star Trek IV. So it's interesting to see kind of this different take on her. And I'm invested in her fate, essentially. And I can understand why Spock would be torn apart witnessing the death of his mother. So ultimately, does he have mommy issues? You know, like, I wouldn't say that, but he does have a relationship that is displayed prominently with his mother, according to the franchise.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And in the original series, Sarek was very much the dominant personality in the relationship with Spock, right? In terms of the parental relationship. Would you say when we get to the J.J. Abrams, it's more even-keeled between Amanda and Sarek?
Yeah, I would say so, because I think Sarek, I don't know, I even think maybe he takes a bit of a back seat to the relationship with Amanda in the J.J. Abrams universe. So
yeah, like, it doesn't seem really torn up with the conflict between the two of them over him joining Starfleet, right. Whereas the death of Amanda seems to be more of the big emotional factor for the character of Spock.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting the way that the two takes have looked at this character and how she's still a bit of a cipher to me as a character. Like, I would be down to learn more about Amanda. I don't know if it's going to happen, though.
Yeah. Cam, why don't we jump over to, I think, the mother of all mothers here. When we talk about
that. So we're going to skip over TNG because there's nothing there, right?
No, I don't think there's one single character that has a memorable
there
mother.
There is no big mother figure that dominates the screen every time, you know, no?
No, no. Let's dive right into Sarah Sisko. Yeah.
Who?
No. Let's not
bury the lead.
Okay, it's Loxana Troi. This is the, and Deanna Troi for that matter. If there's any character that has mother issues in all of Star Trek, it's Deanna here. And Cam, do you feel anything but just sorry for Deanna having to deal with her relationship with this woman?
I'm a little more sympathetic to Loxana, maybe, but I can understand the point of view of both characters. And I think we'll talk maybe a little more specific about some of the episodes, but I think one of the things I really got from Loxana doing the research for this is that Loxana is Loxana, and she accepts, you know, I don't know. It's like
she
trying
accepts.
To, I shouldn't say she accepts.
No way. That is the big issue.
Yeah,
here.
She doesn't. She doesn't. But she,
like,
she's a big brassy, full of opinions, and it's kind of a little bit dominates the room. But she's never gonna change, and
no.
I think that's the issue. And I think Troy was put in a position, probably at a young age, of essentially being the adult in the relationship.
And do you think it's just a losing battle, expecting Deanna to expect her mother to change?
Yes, I do. And yeah. I think that's maybe that's a little bit where my conflict in the relationship okay. comes in that a lot of the time it's Deanna telling mother, don't do this. Mother, don't do that. It's like, have you met this woman?
Yeah. But isn't it amazing, though, like everyone might find stuff that your mother does just delightful,
mm-hmm.
but it may just push your buttons in a way that makes you kind of like freak out. And people are like, why are you reacting to that? Who cares? You
right.
know? And I think that's pretty much the entire relationship between Deanna and Loxana. Although a lot of the stuff, I should say 99% of the stuff that Loxana pulls,
mm-hmm.
I think Deanna's totally in the right to feel outraged by this.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, let's get into it though, Cam.
Right.
I think she's very much defined this relationship about, I'm going to find you a man. You need to settle down. You need to have a husband. You need to start a family. Who cares about your career? Loxana constantly undermines Deanna's career, which I think like that must be torturous, you know. I'm trying to rationalize it here, and I think what it is Loxana is projecting her own insecurities upon
yes.
her daughter, where Loxana is constantly on the hunt. That's one of her defining, perhaps her most defining characteristic, is she's constantly on the hunt for another mate or husband.
Yeah, I don't think Loxana has ever found like comfort or strength in being independent.
No, which is funny because she's like this important ambassador. She seems to have this certain guile about mm-hmm. her, but. Do you think she's ultimately a very insecure woman?
I do.
Yeah.
But she's someone who, I mean, honestly, if you had to choose between going to dinner with Loxana or Deanna for just like a social evening, who would you prefer? I think I'd take Loxana, because Loxana is just like this force of energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we've laughed in the past about the episode, the one with Alexander, where they go to the Cost of Living,
where
man. She talks about how, you know, she's exposed Deanna to all these adventures over life, and look how boring she turned out. You know, I love that, and I love that Loxana is a character who embraces life.
Yeah.
Which is so the opposite of a lot of what the TNG cast does. They're so much more reserved.
Oh, yeah. But do you think her behavior... Loxana's behavior is appropriate in how she clearly knows how much she's upsetting her daughter.
Yeah, that's
and
the
she
issue.
Persists with this.
I understand why she maybe doesn't have the utmost respect for sort of the decorum and regal nature of Starfleet.
I buy that.
Which is very buttoned down. We joke about it all the time that they can be a little stuffy, right? So someone like Loxana is like, come on, guys, lighten up. You know, you only live once. And I can understand her frustrations, but yeah, you're right. Like, she doesn't show the respect to Deanna's coworkers. Like, this is her daughter's essentially job. It's her career.
Well, yeah,
and look what she's doing to like Captain Picard
or Riker.
Yeah,
yeah, and or even in Manhunt, she was thinking about even little Wesley as a potential mate as well, which
right?
Is, disturbing as well.
I love her first episode. This is what I really rediscovered.
Oh, Haven.
Haven, yeah,
yeah.
Which was, to me, like a completely forgettable episode until I rewatched it. I was like, this episode is gold. I think there's actually a lot of really great stuff here.
I think you and I should dive into Haven itself, because there's a lot to pick apart, you know.
I think a lot of the relationship stuff really comes from that episode, and you see a lot of it recycled in future episodes, and, you know, there's obviously some later ones that delve into new material, but...
Yeah.
You know, Manhunt, Menage a Trois, a lot of these are kind of recycling the beats of Haven.
I think the first one that we're introduced to is, you know, essentially Loxana's telling Deanna, think it, don't say it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's a constant thing that's, who do you think's in the right here? You know, is Loxana being rude by using telepathy in front of people that can only use spoken language?
I would say so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a social, it's sort of the socially acceptable thing, right?
It's like if you're in the company of people, they all speak English,
right?
And maybe they also all speak French, but you don't speak French, and they insist on all just speaking French to each other, and you're entirely left out of the conversation.
Right. Yeah. Like I once had two coworkers, and they both spoke Tagalog. And one spoke Tagalog to the other one, and the other one was like, no, we don't speak that way in front of everyone else here.
Right.
And it was, and like I was like oblivious. I was like, huh? What's going on? But it was the fact that, yeah, it's sort of that, it's kind of respect for the people around you. And obviously, if you have a telepathy, you definitely have a, you can really get some zingers in there without anyone knowing.
Well, okay. You could get some zingers in there with everyone knowing, though. What about the this back and forth between her in-laws, that her future in-laws that she was having?
Are you talking about the dinner table scene?
Was this uncomfortable to watch?
This was amazing. With Mr. Hom hitting the gong. You know, we don't often talk about Star Trek comedy that works.
Okay.
I actually think this is a really, really well-staged, building tension sort of comedic scene.
Sure. No. Oh. It was okay. Building tension in that it was, I felt like I wanted to crawl out of my skin.
It reminded me of that scene in Boogie Nights with the guy who's throwing firecrackers in the background with Mr. Hom playing that role.
Okay. I thought you were going to talk about the donut shop scene where I'm just like, oh, okay. You and I should maybe do a commentary episode one of these days, but I want to focus on Deanna here, but Mr. Hom getting drunk and his reactions to Data's inquiries about his level of drunkenness. I was just like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that dinner table sequence, look, you have, Loxana, she is really like going at it with the in-laws, insisting on the naked Betazoid wedding. Mm-hmm. She's even wrapping around like this weird like plant-like pet.
Yeah,
like, over
that was something.
Yeah, over her future in-law, and just like I thought they were also friends, like back or like they were friends through Deanna Troi's father, I suppose. But
right.
Like, why are you doing this to somebody that you like?
Well, there's an episode later down the road with Loxana, Half a Life, where she gets in a relationship with a guy who they commit suicide at the age of 60. And we see when she explodes at him, it's coming from insecurity and anxiety, right? Do you get the sense in Haven that her behavior towards the future mother-in-law is coming from either of these things? Or does it just seem mean-spirited to you?
To me, it seems mean-spirited.
Yeah,
that's
the way I felt.
Yeah, and it's not, and it's mean-spirited not only towards the in-laws, but to Deanna as well, because Deanna explodes.
What about Deanna's promised one?
Oh, God. What was this? What were they thinking here?
Oh, it's so great.
Okay. But Deanna, like, this is, it was disconcerting to watch Deanna explode, because we never see her out of control like this. And I was just like, I was utterly taken aback. It's still early enough in the run that they don't quite have a strong grasp of the characters, and they maybe didn't know how out of character it was for Deanna to act like this. But
right.
I think it's actually pretty much in character when she's around Loxana.
Yeah. Yeah, I never understood Loxana's behavior in this scene. Is it just like an insecure, like, has to assert her dominance over this other woman, like alpha female?
I think maybe.
How much time is she planning on spending with this woman in the future?
Maybe not all that much.
Yeah.
I mean, they are like half a galaxy apart at most days, right? So did she just get her kicks out of like making other people really uncomfortable?
Yeah. Right. And talking about how the woman's husband is like thinking about her naked?
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty funny.
Actually, you know, it was pretty funny when Deanna's chosen one was trying to hit it off with her in the holodeck. And he's just like, and I saw my dad practicing being naked in front of the mirror. And he started sucking in his gut.
Yeah.
And they're talking about the Betazed wedding. I was like, why is he watching his father get naked in the mirror? Who's writing this stuff?
I'm confused about Loxana, because Loxana in some ways is very traditional. And in other ways, she's against the traditions of other cultures, as we see in Half a Life.
Yeah.
And I could never quite put my finger on what, because in many ways, she strikes me as a character who would be a little more rebellious, and a little, you know, not being confined by the structures of her society.
Right.
But in other ways, she's incredibly stubborn about following them, more so than Deanna.
On the one hand, you could just say it's because of the convenience of the writers, you know, where they want to take it. But I think that there's probably maybe some cognitive dissonance on her part, where it's just I think ultimately Loxana's most concerned about herself. Would you call her a selfless character? Or would you call her the most, or Star Trek's most selfish character? Because there are moments in, like, say, Menage a Troy, where she does have that sacrifice, you know, to save her daughter and Will. You know, she thought that it could have been her end or life with, you know, the Ferengi in the Ferengi vessel. But I think ultimately, Loxana cares mostly about what Loxana wants first and foremost. Yeah. And so if that means undermining her daughter, undermining other cultures, I don't think she really cares too much.
They give her, like, poignant scenes, because the one you name in Menage a Troy, as well as, like, her appearances in Deep Space Nine with Odo.
Yeah.
Often it's about her, you know, like that scene where Odo turns back into a liquid and she's, like, cradling him and says, "Don't worry, this won't leave the two of us." It's like when she really cares about someone, she's willing to kind of sacrifice and be very maternal towards them, but she always puts up kind of a front.
She has moments of vulnerability.
Yeah.
So do you think the behavior that we usually see, do you think it's all really just a front to mask her insecurity?
I would have to believe, because it's just so much bigger than life.
Let me ask you this, Cam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to jump forward a little bit to the episode Dark Page.
Yeah, my favorite episode.
Which was an incredibly depressing, like, episode to watch. Yeah. And, you know, but anyways, essentially we find out that Loxana actually had a daughter before Deanna, who died horribly in
drowning.
A picnic, you know? And so it's kind of almost this repressed memory that Loxana doesn't want to deal with. I wonder if this personality that we see her wearing all the time, maybe it's a way to mask a lot of the pain that she was dealing with this daughter. I wonder if this is even her personality before the death of her first daughter.
Well, I mean, Loxana's life has not been easy. You look at, obviously, that, you know, her daughter dies at a very, very young age, which would destroy many people.
Yep.
And then, of course, you know, her husband dies, and then she has other marriages since then that don't work out.
Yep.
Like, Loxana Mavix,
her daughter is very distant from her.
Yeah.
She doesn't have a, you know, very close relationship with her daughter.
I think Loxana may have gone through more pain than any of the characters on the bridge.
Yeah.
I mean, Worf obviously has had his issues too, but they seem to be more, a lot of them, self-imposed in a lot of ways, whereas Loxana's are, like, awful external things in a lot of cases happening to her.
Yeah. So in a situation like that, we are giving her a hard time, but if you go through so much trauma, I think you maybe, to a certain degree, have to put up this sort of shell, and I think this personality that maybe you and I are complaining about, I think that's just a shell that she has to wear in order to not feel constantly vulnerable. And we do get glimpses of that, you know, when she's dealing with Alexander or when she's dealing with Odo or in those particular situations.
Mm-hmm.
Cam.
I had actually a question for you, and this is sort of a theory I had watching, and you may kind of laugh or snicker initially, but maybe just give it some thought.
Okay.
You know, Roddenberry loved to revisit ideas, right? Like, you know, if something worked the first time, he might want to revisit it. When we look at the character of Harry Mudd in the original series, he's sort of this kind of a guy who's sort of more into, say, maybe the carnal side of human nature. He's doesn't have sort of the stiff upper lip that the Starfleet crew does, and he's kind of like a hand grenade thrown in to kind of throw the crew off balance.
Right.
And he's a comedic figure. Whether people find him funny is another, you know, question altogether. But do you think that was maybe the intention of Loxana Troy, especially early on? You throw her in once a season as a way of upsetting these characters who are otherwise very, you know, have stature, you know, statuesque.
Well, I think first and foremost, she was introduced because she is Majel Barrett. Is the wife of Gene Roddenberry.
Of course.
And from everything you hear from the actors, Majel Barrett is essentially playing herself with Loxana.
Right.
Here. That said, I think, look, you've got these very, very stuffy characters.
Mm-hmm.
Let's throw in I'm sure some writers are just like, well, what happened if Majel Barrett hung out with these stiff people?
Right.
You know, let's throw a little grenade in there. And, like, it's interesting because they weren't supposed to have internal conflict on, you know, Star Trek The Next Generation. So you have to bring in these external factors here. And, I do agree with you. Like, she could be a bit of a hand grenade that they use to really blow up the status quo with these very stuffy characters.
And in both cases, the characters are very polarizing with fans. Like, a lot of fans really don't like them.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to me, like, because Roddenberry was famous for recycling ideas over and over again, that I wonder if that was a bit of the intent initially, especially when you watch an episode like Haven, which is so weird.
Yeah.
And she's acting so obnoxious.
One of the other things that I do want to mention about Loxana, though, is something that I don't appreciate, and I think Troy has every right to be upset, but just the way that she undermines her career.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly believe that Troy in Cost of Living was giving Worf and Alexander bad advice when she was telling them to draw up a contract.
Yeah.
I think that's horrible advice to give a single parent and a child, mm-hmm. essentially. But for Loxana to come on to the ship and try to undermine all that, I think that's awful thing to do, you know, to right. your daughter, essentially. But do you think... How much self-awareness do you think Loxana ultimately has?
I don't think she has much at all.
Yeah.
I think Loxana has her... Loxana's going to give advice. And I don't know that Loxana is good at giving advice.
Sure.
I think, depending... You know, I think Loxana is a great character. You know, look, Cost of Living is no one's favorite episode. I think Loxana is a great character to have with Alexander.
Right.
Because okay. I think Alexander is such a, you know, withdrawn, you know, shy child with a father who's very distant. And a character like Loxana, who's just like exploding with like love and, you know, enthusiasm for life, like that's a very positive figure for someone like him to have.
Let me throw this out to you, Cam, a bit of a hypothetical here. What would happen if Majel Barrett was a series regular? What would she be doing on the ship week to week?
Oh my god, like, oh, she's actually a member of like Starfleet.
Well, not a member of Starfleet, but like, what if,
or is she gonna be like Shran, like they were gonna do for season 5 Enterprise, where she's an advisor in the back room?
Sure. No, you know what, let's say maybe not a series regular, let's say she's like a Whoopi Goldberg, where she shows up every third or fourth episode.
I was gonna say, is she like Neelix? She's like the social director.
Yeah, it's something that
she'd be good at that. She'd be decorating, you know, the 10 forward for holidays.
Would the writers be forced to give her more nuance, or would just audiences revolt against having to deal with a very much blood-curdling presence in the series on such a constant basis?
I would have to believe if they're stuck with this character every episode or every, you know, however many episodes a season, that they're going to have to figure out ways to give her nuance.
Yeah.
The thing is, I do think Loxana Troi does have nuance on the show.
Sure.
But it just seems like it takes them a while. I mean, I'm sure initially they're like, yeah, write Majel a really fun role, right?
Yeah.
And then like, hey, let's bring her back for another comedy. But by the time you get to season 7, you can't recycle the same thing like they did for the first 2 or 3 over and over and over again. And so you could tell that they're trying to find new facets to the character because... I mean, my God, can you imagine 7 takes of Manhunt?
Well, Cam, let me throw this at you as well. Are there any good Loxana Troi episodes?
You know what? I like Half a Life. Okay. That is one I just rewatched, and it was one I had maybe the least memory of any of the Loxanas. I actually really enjoyed seeing her like in this sort of romantic relationship.
But don't you think a lot of the fact that it's a solid episode is, I think it's an intriguing premise as well.
Yeah.
And I think, was it David Ogden Stiers?
He's great in that episode.
He was pretty dang good in that one.
Very, very good.
And I think the chemistry that they have and bounce off each other.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think Menage a Troi is actually a pretty fun episode.
Yeah.
But all the other Loxana episodes, like I remember like sitting down, I'm just like, great, you know. I just find her as a character to be a little grating, and it bothers me how much she does not respect her daughter,
right.
And how it doesn't really put Deanna in the best light either. And like it makes Deanna look weak in a way that I don't really like from that character, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's a little head-scratching that they wrote 2 Loxana episodes that are essentially about menopause.
Yeah.
It's like, really? Like one in TNG and in Manhunt, and then also in the episode Fascination in Deep Space Nine. It's like, in both cases, they're like, I got it.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the Loxana character is about aging, too. We see that in Half a Life, as well as those 2 episodes I just named. I mean, and obviously this perpetual search for a man, you know, despite her daughter's objections or whatever. It's about the fact she's getting older and, you know, she's scared.
Do you think that could ever be a plot line nowadays in modern Trek? Like, how...
No.
It's... You won't... Your life won't be complete unless you find the right man.
Do you think, though...
I don't think it works any... Well, yeah.
I mean, do you think the show comes down on the side that she's right to be doing this, though? I don't know. I don't...
But the thing is that the show keeps perpetuating this thread, which makes my skin crawl.
Right.
You know, and it's... No, because, you know, Deanna comes straight out and she snaps at her and I think in Dark Page and says, this is my family. You know, this is Menage a Trois, rather.
Right.
This is my family. This is my career. This is what I care about. You need to respect that. I would not believe that the writers are ultimately trying to say that your life is not going to be complete without a man. But the fact that this is a constant thread, this is a the fact that somebody in the 24th century woman is obsessing over this, I would hope that's not actually the case.
It does very much feel like they're transplanting a very common trope of like 1980s comedy into the 24th century without any updating or, you know, any sort of alterations.
I just wonder, like, what comedy bits they'll have in Discovery that are going to look very dated, you know, 20, 30 years from now? Or it's just like, whoa, I can't believe that there are...
A lot of, like, awkward office camera stuff, single camera... Documentary style.
Yeah. Okay.
Characters just like staring off into space.
So, Cam, any final thoughts on One Loxana Troi?
She's such a problematic character in so many ways. You know, obviously the episodes they give her, but also my own response to her. She's a character who, you know, I joked, oh God, a while back about us doing a Loxana episode.
Yeah. What was my reaction, Cam?
It was the blankest of stares, basically.
I was really just thinking about all the research I'd have to do with watch like all 8 episodes. Or I was just like, oh, really?
Yeah, but rewatching them, it's like my feelings are conflicted because a lot of the time I like what Majel Barrett is doing, and I think Majel Barrett is a good actress.
Yeah.
I genuinely do. You know, you look at her work as Nurse Chapel, Number One. She's
the voice of the computer.
Yeah, sure. You know, she's always strong. Like, I think, you know, you could always make the argument, you know, nepotism casting her in Star Trek, right, and all these roles. But the thing is, I think she delivers almost every single time. And so I can't argue against it. If it works, why complain?
Right.
And I think as Loxana, I don't fault her at all. I think she nails that character. The question then becomes, does this character belong in Star Trek The Next Generation?
I'll say one episode a season is about all we need. Yeah.
If you had to strike one of them from the record, which one would it be?
Oh, because even the bad ones, there's still enough memorable batshit crazy things going on that, like, even Dark Page, which I found incredibly depressing.
The most depressing one, Tyler, we're going to talk about today?
Well, maybe not, actually.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah, okay, I don't know. To me, I think Manhunt is pretty forgettable.
Yeah.
But Dark Page is pretty depressing. I think maybe ultimately I have to strike Manhunt.
I think I come down on the same page, okay. If you will. Yeah, I think Dark Page is not an episode I enjoy in any way, shape, or form. But I think it adds something to the character, whereas I don't think Manhunt does.
I'll say with Dark Page, there's some intriguing stuff going on. At least you've got them doing some sort of sci-fi stuff with trying to teach a species that doesn't understand spoken language, a telepathic species that has no comprehension of a spoken language, trying to teach them how to speak a spoken language. Yeah. I think that's interesting.
Well, it has Loxana doing something.
Yeah.
She's not just, you know, nagging at Troi.
Yeah. I mean... Dark Page, it's not without its merits, but I definitely would put it at the bottom of the barrel among Loxana episodes.
Right. Now, when we did our Father's Day episode, you know, last June or whatever, we talked kind of in the relationship who was sort of more in the right or who was in the wrong. Do you think, like, Loxana is the one who comes down maybe more in the negative side? Than,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I think Deanna fully in the right to feel upset with her mother here.
Okay. Well, you know, we've now, I think, tackled Loxana Troi with as much depth as we're ready to tonight.
Yeah.
Why don't we move into another...
You want to do another 25 minutes on her, Cam?
I probably could.
Okay.
But let's talk about Geordi LaForge.
Okay.
In this great episode, Interface.
Yeah.
This is the episode where we never really gotten many hints about Geordi's family.
I think we knew that he had Starfleet officers as parents.
And that he kind of bounced between the two, living with, taking turns living with each side. Yeah. But in this episode, we find out his mother has gone missing in action. And what is this episode about? He's got this new interface that's allowing them to investigate a ship that's trapped in a gas giant. And then his mother appears on this ship.
Yeah. Essentially, he's using like kind of a drone that's hooked up to his implants for his visor to check out this missing ship. And his mother's on this missing ship.
Season 7, people.
Yeah. Let's not spend too much time on this one. Because what I think the important thing here, though, is that we do see that Geordi can get obsessed with something related to his mother. Yeah. It's eventually revealed that this is not actually his mother that he's dealing with. It's like some alien taking his mother's form.
Yes.
But I think the important thing here is that Geordi cares about his mom and he'll do everything he can to try to save her.
Do you think Geordi was being pretty irrational throughout this episode in the sense that, like, this is not really acting like his mother?
It really doesn't.
At least I don't think so.
I don't think so either. But it doesn't paint him in a great light. He was throwing out all these weird theories to the captain about possibilities of what could have happened to the ship. And they're all going like, okay, Data, what's the possibility of this? And Data's like, well, I guess it's technically possible, but I don't know. Geordi doesn't look great. Good to know that he does care about his mom. So
yeah, I mean, this is a terrible episode. This is really bad.
I
would choose every Loxana episode over this.
Yeah,
everyone.
I can't disagree with you there.
Yeah,
this is, you know, really season 7 and it's nadir. I'd have to say
it does actually though introduce a Riker mom anecdote.
Okay.
That, you know, because Riker's a character, again, so many of these characters, the mothers are never really mentioned, but in this episode Riker talks about how his mother died when he was 2 and he didn't really have much of a memory, so he would always tell, you know, friends stories about his mother so much that he began to believe she was still alive. And then when he was 5 and he went to school, a teacher and his father sat him down and made him accept her death. And he said that was the day she died to him.
Well, that's pretty dark.
That is real dark. That's dark page dark.
Oh, yeah, it is. Okay.
Now, do you ever get any sense through the series, because this is obviously season 7 where there's a lot of, you know, rewriting and retconning at the end, that Riker ever really had any sort of mother issues? We know he had father issues big time.
No, I really don't think so. It's just kind of little. I think they were looking for a character who we didn't know anything about their mother. So they're like, hey, Riker, here's some mother talk there. There you go. Another character I think we should touch upon, though, very briefly as well. Data, we're introduced to Dr. Noonien.
Khan.
it gets confusing because
it does.
Dr. Noonien Singh's wife, you know, essentially Data's mother, and he figures out through her violin playing that she's
too perfect.
So she's in fact an android. Does Data
this,
really?
This raises questions to me about Dr. Soong that I do not want to know.
I know exactly where you're going. Does Data have mother issues, Cam? Really?
No, this is definitely a sort of single episode reference.
Yeah.
But I think it's actually a good episode. And I did enjoy that it showed that, you know, like they bonded over like creative pursuits. Even though she's artificial, she allows Data to feel human, essentially. Like that's the closest he gets to like some human moments. And it is with an artificial being. And I think there's some value to that.
It's better than bonding over Barclay's hollow pursuits. I agree.
Just a little.
Anyway.
So why don't we move on? Because I don't think that's an ongoing issue with Data. Data's got daddy issues, but he doesn't really have any mother issues.
Sure.
So let's jump over to Worf, who I think is a more complicated character, and that he seems to have resentment towards his stepmother. His real mother, name's not even listed on Memory Alpha. We don't really know that much.
I'd call her the adopted mother.
Yes, the adopted mother.
Helena Rozenko. Yeah. Look, it seems as if, is this one patient woman?
You would have to be.
I have to think.
She's
like
a saint.
I have to believe so. Like this woman, like, look, caring for Worf, who we find out he actually killed a child playing soccer once.
Yeah.
Him beating up teenagers when he was just 8 years old.
Yeah.
This guy, not an easy child to raise, but look, I think she did all right by him. And somebody who obviously embraces his Klingon side. She didn't try to, like, suppress his Klingon culture growing up. And right. Look, by the time that he has his own kid, a kid that he doesn't really feel like raising, then she takes Alexander in as well. So, yes, right. I think Helena's a saint for sure.
She seems like such a sweet-natured woman. Like, she's bending over backwards for Worf. She takes Alexander, as you said. It's like, how is he so grumpy with her? I just feel terrible for her.
I don't get it. You know,
you wish, like, that Riker or a Crusher, whose mother died when she was very young, too, you'd wish they'd go over and be like, hey, Worf, smarten up. Yeah. You don't know what you've got.
Who has it worse, Helena Rozenko or Amanda Grayson?
Oh, excellent question. You know what? I would say Amanda Grayson because Helena has a better husband, I think. A husband that's...
so gay.
Yeah, I think he seems like a nice guy. Plus, you know, Worf maybe didn't turn out so great, but she gets a second chance with Alexander.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Amanda Grayson hasn't gotten that second chance as far as we know.
All right.
So I think the only other real person to talk about in TNG is Beverly Crusher as a mother.
Wait.
Oh.
No, Wesley.
That's what I mean, as a mother.
Oh, as a mother. Yes. Oh, okay. So I'm sorry for interrupting you, Cameron.
Yeah, so I'm horribly insulted.
Yes, yeah.
Because Beverly Crusher, mother died when she was young, still does a damn good job, I think, with Wesley to a certain degree, despite the fact, you know, she didn't really have much of a maternal figure growing up.
Sure, but do they seem close to you?
Like,
you
know, we've talked about that. Yeah, I mean...
Beverly seems to have, like, all the right ingredients for being an ace mom.
Yeah.
But there just seems to be this weird aloofness between those two characters.
How much do you think that is the aloofness of just the writing, on that show?
That's 100% what it is.
Yeah.
Like, how many, I mean, like, that writing staff was made up primarily of, like, white dudes.
Right.
How many of them had that much experience, you know, being mothers to teenage boys?
Yeah, exactly. I think what they do give with Beverly that I like, though, is they have scenes of her supporting Wesley and showing, you know, constant support for him and his pursuits. And even, you know, the moment where Picard says, like, shut up, Wesley. She turns on Picard in that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, even though that is her, you know, superior, she's going to defend Wesley, but then she turns on Wesley, too.
But, Cam.
Yes.
What? Let's get a grip here. Mm-hmm. Because, like, what if your mother was dragging you into turbo lifts and making you stand in a turbo lift and then saying to the captain, my boy wants to look at the bridge? Like, would you appreciate that? Or do you think Beverly's just like, I don't know, that's not a great look for, she's a bit of a helicopter parent there.
I think the issue is, and it's sort of a disconnect because we say that about, you know, dragging your kid into your job. The thing is about the Enterprise, it's your home. So I think that the line is a little blurrier because, you know, they live with these people. They spend so much time together. It's not like your boss. Like, I don't know my mom's boss, you know, or when she had a boss. She's retired now, but I don't know who that was.
Yeah.
You know, but...
Okay, let me throw another example at you.
Sure.
Journey's End.
One of my favorites.
Well, no, but she's contacting Wesley's instructors at the academy and saying, like, how's he doing? What's his attitude like?
Yeah.
And then she's reporting back to Wesley, like, your instructors say that you've been really distant lately. If my mom, when I was going to university, was contacting my professors,
yeah,
I'd be really pissed off, like, genuinely. Do you think that's kind of a violation of, you know, Wesley's an adult at this point.
Yeah, well, she definitely, I think, becomes a little more meddlesome with him as he gets older, especially in that regard. But also, like, there's the Traveler stuff is weird. You know? In fact, you know what? If Beverly's going to be meddlesome with the Traveler.
Sure.
Be like, who is this guy and why are you going with him?
Yeah.
The Traveler should be having to have an interview with Beverly before Wesley goes off with him.
All right. What do you make of that year-long gap she spent not raising her son while she was chief of Starfleet Medical?
Yeah, what do you think they were going to do had Gates McFadden never come back? Like, say Diana Muldaur becomes, like, a regular cast member in season 3 through 7. Is Wesley just there for, like, at least the next 2 seasons?
Yeah.
2-3 seasons? Just like, yep, mom's still not back. I'm, like, 15.
No. You know what they do? It's like they have all these cutaway shots of, like, him just turning off his view screen in his quarter saying, yeah, that was a good conversation with mom.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's also in that era where, like, you know, look, if a cast member leaves, do they really want to spend that much time acknowledging them? Like,
right.
Back in the 80s, 90s, that didn't really happen that much.
No,
so
they were kind of like an FU when someone left.
Yeah.
It was, like, often quite cold.
So I was actually kind of surprised that they referenced not Tar, Yar as much as they did after Denise Crosby's departure. I just said departure.
Departure. You keep you got Armus on the brain.
Armus Tarmus. Yeah. All right, Cam.
It is true because they never mentioned Pulaski again.
Yeah.
You know, after she leaves, but whereas like Dasha Yar. Oh yeah, sure.
Okay, Cam, let's jump over to Deep Space Nine. I think we can briefly touch upon Ben Sisko, who discovers that his wasn't really raised by his birth mother. His birth mother was possessed by the prophets.
Of course.
Had sex with Joe Sisko, got impregnated, the prophets departed, and she took off. Do you blame her? Look, if an alien possesses me and all of a sudden I find myself with child, I'd be like, what the hell just happened here?
Yeah, and wasn't she dead by the time Joseph Sisko tracked her down?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sarah Sisko is a tragic figure in the world of Deep Space Nine. You know? Yeah. We talk about her often. Yeah, that would definitely be a pretty unsettling.
Yeah.
Like, how conscious was she during this period? Was she like
I feel like it's, you know, in Being John Malkovich, where like at certain point you can jump into the head, but you can't really control the body or anything like that.
Was she a puppeteer?
Yeah. I feel bad for her. What do you think about Ben when it comes to his realization that the mother who raised him was not actually his birth mother?
He seems to handle it pretty well.
Yeah.
Like, Ben is not a character who I feel was greatly traumatized by this.
Right.
Which I kind of like. I like when the characters have a major moment like this and kind of are able to accept it.
Okay.
You know, because a lot of time they use that for cheap drama with characters.
Like Jordy LaForge. Okay. Why don't we, speaking of Sisko's, I think we need to touch upon Jake and Jennifer and that relationship.
No issues there.
Mother killed by the Borg.
Yeah.
Moving on. No. Yeah. You know, we don't necessarily think that Jennifer Sisko is the most dynamic character.
Right.
I do appreciate what they were doing with that one Mirror Universe episode where she comes back and builds a relationship with Jake.
Yeah.
That brings up a lot of question marks of, you know, I genuinely feel bad for Jake in that a woman identical to his mother, and assuming a lot of similar personality
traits that his dad is spending time with.
Yeah. Like, that's going to mess with your head there.
Or is it something where he's, like, very hopeful about it? And he is in the episode. Like, to him, this is maybe, like, it's her. You know, it could be her. And we see traits that she has that are very similar. She, you know, she's not like a space pirate like most, it seems, of these Mirror Universe people.
No.
She's actually remarkably well-composed.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe the one benefit that Jake really has here is that I think he's had a strong father figure in his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was able to have this continuity of a constant parental figure, no matter the death of his mother at a young age and in a tragic way.
Well, I love that, you know, DS9 created a world where Ben is a Sisko. A Sisko father.
Thumbs up or thumbs down?
He's a Sisko father. Oh, Sisko. Yeah. He's a single father, but Jake turns out well. There's not this constant drama or infighting, which,
it's,
you know,
no Kyle Riker situation.
No, or Troy and Loxana. Right. You know, you see all these situations where it's these single parents in, not just Star Trek, lots of drama or TV series, where the children turn out like nightmares or just have constant problems. I love that Jake adjusts to it and they are happy together.
I like the biggest issue that Jake and Ben ever had was Jake hanging out with Nog.
Yeah.
You know, that's just like a small story. You know, it's a nice thing that all, you know, teenagers go through, you know, the bad influence, you know. Yeah. So
I never got the sense, though, that Jake was more tormented about the death of his mother than most, you know, kids would be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's okay with Sisko starting to date again. You know, he's not someone who's, you know, really like stuck in the past, essentially. He's able to move forward, which I think speaks very highly of the writing of the Jake Sisko character, who fans maybe don't always love, but I think that's a really smart take on that character.
Okay. Those two characters don't necessarily have huge mother issues. I think one character that does, though, after Loxana, Troy, I think the next most notable mother character, though, is Moogie or Ishka, Quark's mother on Deep Space Nine. This is fascinating to me because Quark is obviously kind of the protagonist here, but he's such a little dick. You know, let's just be honest, you know, with the whole, like, women making profit. This is in Family Business when she's first introduced, and Quark's going to lose his bar because the Ferengi Commerce Association discovers that his mother is actually dares to make profit as a woman, which is forbidden on Ferenginar. But I think I like Family Business. Like, this is like a fun Ferengi episode to watch. And the fact that ultimately Ishka pulls one on Quark, where she actually keeps a lot of the money that he didn't even know about. I like that Quark's essentially kind of proven wrong throughout all of this, even though he is, of course, the protagonist here.
Right. Yeah. I always thought the conflict between Quark and his mother, Moogie, was really interesting in that she's not a traditionalist. She never really was. You know, she didn't chew up food. She wouldn't, or she wore clothes. You know, she would speak to strangers.
Just that horrified Quark. Like, yes. Quark was just absolutely miserable with, like, a mother who would embarrass him like that.
But would you say Quark is a very traditional Ferengi? Like, to me, Quark seems to me a little bit more worldly than most.
I think, okay, if you look at early Quark,
yeah,
I think the Federation rubbed off on him quite a bit, you know.
Right.
By the time we get to... But by the time we get to, was it Dogs of War? I think the last Moogie Zek episode, and Rom is making his ascension to become the next Grand Nagus.
I'm sure nothing would ever go wrong with that.
But he okay, think about this. Look, Rom and Moogie are much closer.
Yes.
And Moogie is the nonconformist here, and it's essentially Rom that becomes the Grand Nagus, because he is kind of this non-traditional Ferengi as well, even though he started off in a different, very different place in Quark. And Quark, honestly, like I say, like, by the end of Deep Space Nine, you can see that he's far more progressive than he was at the start of it.
Right, yeah.
And I think it's because of his time spent with the Federation.
Do you think Quark is a character who, because his mom is pretty rebellious, it causes him almost to get pulled in the opposite direction? Like, Quark might be a little more open-minded, but because it's his mother, it's like that instant whiplash, like, oh, no.
No, I think that's a very good point. And it's an episode you and I absolutely loathe, but Prophet and Lace is kind of a fascinating look at how much vitriol he actually has for his mother. It's not just like, oh, they all just got over all their decades-long family issues in Family Business. Is this carries over very deep feelings that they have of just animosity for, I guess, a lot of the stress that Ishka puts on Quark's life here.
Yeah. It's interesting about Quark, because Quark wants to make a name for himself. Like, he, throughout the series, wants to make some sort of imprint, right?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's getting rich or what have you, having his own moon like Cousin Gala.
Yeah.
His mother is the one who accomplishes the most. She's, you know, reforming, like, Ferenginar.
Yeah.
She's the one who will be remembered. And Rom, too, I guess, too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll be for good reasons or bad. That's for the future to say. Wow. But Quark is the one left out of the picture.
But would Quark want to be remembered as the reformist of Ferenginar?
Is there profit in it?
Probably, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's the question.
Like, because the whole thing is they're introducing reforms, which would not make them such a profit-centered society.
Right.
So, I think Quark's okay with his lot as it is.
Do you think so?
By the time we get to Dogs of War,
he's
proclaiming that Quark's bar will be the last remaining vestige of the Ferenginar that we all know and love. Like, he's not going to succumb to all the reforms that are going on the planet. So.
Right.
I don't know. Quark's a fascinating character to me, because there's just so much, I don't know, inner conflict with him. Like, a creature that could just seem so vile on the surface, you know, kind of deep down, he's a good fella. He's not selling. He feels conflicted about selling weapons. You know, he'll save Odo's life and drag him to the top of a mountain, for example.
Right. Now, say these reforms had been pushed by Zek, or Zek's son, who's in that season one episode. Right. Say he was the successor. Do you think Quark would have been as against them?
Probably not. No, probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the Ishka factor there.
Do you think he ever resolves his mother issues?
Never. I do not believe that. And I think Prophet and Lace is very telling in that regard.
Right.
So, Cam, why don't we jump over? We went from kind of a fun mother son sort of dynamic.
Yeah.
To one of the darkest
the pits of hell.
Yeah.
Is okay. We're gonna talk about yes, the episode Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night. This is the episode where Kira discovers that her mother was a comfort woman, against her will, for the Cardassians, and ended up engaged in a love affair with Gul Dukat.
Could anything make Kira want to vomit more than this?
Is this the most depressing episode of Star Trek?
I remember, okay, I watched this in pretty quick succession to Dark Page.
Yeah.
So I just remember having like this afternoon of feeling quite glum, but I had forgotten just how dark this was.
Yeah.
From the time that you've seen her, okay, nothing got me more than when I saw Maru being pulled away from her family. And like just the children, the babies crying.
Not just her though, but like all the women being pulled away.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, I didn't remember this being this grim.
I'm glad that they tackle this issue when you're talking about kind of an occupation, you know, of Cardassians on Bajor. Like, it's right. Obviously something that they're not just going to, like, dust under the floor mat or anything like that, or sweep under the mat. But, like, I keep making up these new turns of phrase. Anyways, but I do appreciate this. But, man, I did not remember how dark this episode was. And even by the end of it, Kira essentially gets to go back in time through the Orb of Time.
Very convenient Orb of Time.
Clever name there, guys. Yeah. And witness all of this. And she even tries to assassinate Dukat with a bomb and kill her mother at the same time until she realizes that the mother is doing it for her family. She's finding out that her children are being fed and getting medical supplies. It's confirmed through an isolinear rod from her husband.
Right.
And Kira has second thoughts and decides not to murder Dukat and Maru. But at the end of the episode, Kira's just like, I'm still not convinced I should not have let my mother die. Like, she still really, really resents her mother for having that, carrying on that relationship with Dukat there.
This is a very, very good episode because it is incredibly ambiguous.
It doesn't tell you what the right answer is. It's just like, huh.
Not only that, but we don't know how we feel even by the end about Kira's mom.
Okay, well, let's talk about it, though. Because the whole debate was, is she a collaborator or not? I think the answer is she is a collaborator.
Yeah.
Is she in the right to do this? Because if we look at how dire that situation was, these are children that are essentially just drinking broth, and like Bajoran thugs are trying to like knife them for the broth.
Right.
I can understand why Maru would, you know, agree to be Dukat's lover, right?
Right. Yeah, like the thing is, I can understand why she makes the sacrifice. It's the fact that then they show the character kind of leaning a little more into it.
She seems to actually like Dukat, and I think that's the issue.
That's the part that really rubs you wrong. Like, it's really unsettling. And you can understand why, you know, Kira is so outraged by what is going on and disgusted. And what makes it even worse is the fact they have a Cardassian character say, oh, he's done this a few times now.
Yeah.
Like, this is an act for him. And, oh, man.
But didn't they reveal that they carried on their affair for about 7 years or something?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. I guess.
But, and I'll say this. I can understand somebody falling under the spell of one Gul Dukat. You know?
I've fallen under it many times.
I mean, from most observers, he looks like this very obvious slime ball.
Right.
But, hey, maybe he can convince a couple people that he's not, so.
He is kind of...
Yeah, like those, the Paw Wraith cultists. Yeah.
Or Kai Winn.
Yeah.
He has a certain, like, suave kind of look and feel to him, like... You understand why when he walks into a room, even though a lot of the Cardassians all look very similar, you can understand why eyes fall on him.
Yeah.
Which is a huge credit to Mark Alimo and his performance.
Yeah.
But when I was watching this episode, you know, this falls just over halfway through season six, about maybe 2/3 through. was this a bridge too far to ever come back for Dukat? Because we've seen Dukat do horrible things, but he's kind of like the joke, you know, the Heath Ledger joke or whatever. You're still just like, this guy's awesome, even though we see him do horrendous things. You know, Dukat kind of comes back to their side sometimes, and then, you know, uneasy ally, and we're like, man, what a badass. Was this the point where Dukat became truly irredeemable? I think it might be.
Yeah. Like, truly, truly irredeemable.
Like, there was no coming back from this, I don't think, for that character.
What was with the message he sent Kira? Like, hey, just wanted to call,
that was
you,
weird.
Call you on your mother's birthday and let you know that I banged her
that
for 7 years.
That is so fucked up. I mean, like...
Like, that... yes.
When I'm watching that, I'm like, what the hell?
I was watching that, like, my mouth agape.
Was
like,
he drunk?
That's a... Like, yeah, how else can you, like, explain his behavior? Yeah. Like, we've seen Dukat do some weird-ass things before, and, like, sociopathic things before. Like, why did he do this? Like, why? What was his motivation?
Not only the time of night, too. This is, like, I don't know. We're going to say it's, what, like, maybe 2 a.m., say.
Sure.
Say 2 a.m., he's calling her on a video screen to be like, hey, I banged your mom.
Yeah.
Like, he's got to be drunk, right?
Too much Kinar?
Is that it? Like, what other reason does he have?
Maybe he's already fallen under the spell of the Paw Race at this point.
Okay.
You know, maybe that's what it is.
I don't know. But I do think, yeah, this is kind of the breaking point for Dukat, I think.
Okay.
Because after that, yeesh.
Well, Cam, maybe we touch upon Ezri Dax, though.
Yeah.
A prodigal daughter. We're introduced to her family.
Weirdly, we know nothing about Jadzia's mother, but Ezri, we do.
Hey, you got to give that one season character at least a couple storylines as well.
Yes, we find out like she had a very domineering mother she doesn't speak to.
Yeah.
And that two of her brothers have gone to work for the Orion Syndicate.
Eh?
And one of them is a murderer.
Yeah. Will that create... do you think this is a good mother?
Yeah. No, what's weird about this, and the episode is, Prodigal Daughter we're talking about... you know, Loxana Troi, in many ways, is a similar type of character where she's a very domineering mother who, you know, obviously clashes big time with her Starfleet daughter. What's weird to me about this episode is that really the mother has no positive qualities. Like, it's like, here's a terrible mother. There you have it.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, okay, at the end, maybe she's like, well, it was my fault that everything went wrong, but... Whoop-de-doo.
Yeah, at least Kira's mom was trying to justify it by it's for the best for her family.
Yeah.
I don't quite get. Ezri seems like a fairly well-adjusted... Well, I don't know if I'd call Ezri the most well-adjusted character, but
she's
like,
young, though. So.
All things considered, yeah. She seems to have done okay under this woman, but I don't know. Not a great mother situation here.
No. And what do you make of the Bashir relationship with his mother? Because
the
relationship with his father is obviously the big one we talk about, him and Richard Bashir.
I'll just say this. His mom did not go to jail. Richard Bashir went to jail.
Yeah.
So maybe that tells you something, but it seems as if she was very much a facilitator for Richard Bashir's bad behavior. You know, if she called him out on his shit more... I don't think we'd end up with a situation like where, like, yeah, let's go get our child genetically enhanced.
Right.
Sounds like a fun day trip.
Although, when she talks to Bashir about it, she seems very heartbroken about how he struggled as a child.
I think she's quite complicit in this.
Yeah, I do think she is.
And I think he resents her for that as well. I think he's in the right, though. Like, I can understand why he has problems with both his mother and his father.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Cam, why don't we jump over to Star Trek Voyager?
The land of no mothers?
We have Harry Kim, whose mother is a bit of a helicopter mom.
Yes.
We know that. She's messaging the captain, talking about his clarinet.
Yeah. I actually thought there was more to Harry Kim's mother when I went to research this episode. And I was like, no.
Yeah.
She's like a, you know, eighth grade teacher who's, you know, she's very proud of her son. Which actually I didn't recall. I didn't recall her being quite as positive. I recall it more kind of nagging. Because, of course, we just watched that episode recently where about, you know, her calling the captain about the clarinet and all that sort of stuff, which is a little bit questionable. She seems pleasant enough.
Yeah.
Kes's mom convinced her to go live above ground.
Okay.
Props to her, I guess.
Neelix's mom died in a fiery inferno.
Did she?
I think she must have been killed in that war, right?
They only emphasize the two sisters.
Right, okay.
Which is because I was looking for that, but there was nothing really about mother and father.
What about B'Elanna's mom? She raised her. The father is kind of an absentee father in this situation. I don't think B'Elanna had a great relationship with her mother.
Really bad one. She blamed her mother for the, you know, dissolving of the marriage between her and her father.
Yeah,
and it's because of her mom's strong Klingon morals and behavior.
Do you think B'Elanna would have been better off if Helena Rodchenko had raised her instead?
Probably.
Yeah, maybe.
Because we see there's a lot of self-loathing with B'Elanna. Obviously, we can see that in that episode Faces, where there's the two B'Elannas, the Klingon and the human. And with her mother, it's kind of sad. It's kind of like the Spock's mom situation, where Spock is a little more resentful towards the human side. B'Elanna is really resentful of her mother and won't even like talk to her. We really don't get any resolution to any of that until the episode Barge of the Dead, where she helps her mom go to Stovacor.
I like that episode. You're not such a fan of it, but
I didn't think it was a great episode, but I do like that it does serve as a fairly decent resolution to B'Elanna's, you know, struggling with her Klingon heritage.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. Did you ever get the sense though that B'Elanna was tormented by her relationship with her mother?
I get the sense she's more just tormented by her Klingon heritage more than anything else. I don't think it was necessarily like a mother issue.
Yeah. No, I mean, she did name her daughter after her mother.
Oh, there you go.
So she made peace with her, I suppose, because her mother went to live on Kronos. And, you know,
you think it was maybe a bit of a wild child situation where maybe 10 years later you realize, you know, maybe parents were just doing the best that they could?
I'd like to think so.
Okay.
I would like to think so. There was one I want to reference, which is Seven.
Sure, yeah.
I don't think there's any lingering issues, mother issues.
Well, I think we brought up her father last year for...
Yes.
In that it seems like both her parents are idiots.
Yes.
Yes. Let's go... find out more about this very dangerous cybernetic species and get assimilated.
What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah. We're anthropologists.
Where I find Seven interesting is, though, we see between the relationship with the Borg Queen and Janeway, that Seven kind of has these dueling mother figures.
Right.
Do you think there was, like, the absence of her real mother that caused this, or do you think this would have happened no matter what?
I think it's the fact that, look, you do this... If you've been assimilated since you were a kid, I think that that's just inevitable, that you're going to need some sort of parental figure to learn how to be human, essentially, like from the ground up. You know, she's starting from scratch, really. So, yeah, look, I'm just glad that she did have not one, but two mother figures, even though one was evil.
Do you think she ever found a father figure in Owen Paris?
No, do you think Tom did?
Oh, maybe eventually. And the last one that was kind of a wild card I wanted to throw to you, Naomi Wildman and her mother Samantha.
Cam, that I had that one that I wanted to throw at you as well. I feel bad for actress Nancy Hauer, who were like, oh, they want to bring me back and do an episode about my kid. I bet I'm going to be appearing on Star Trek Voyager all the time now.
Yeah,
and she never saw her again.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. After Once Upon a Time.
It's weird because like. Samantha Wildman barely ever shows up again on the show.
Yeah.
Naomi seems just fine. But we did question Samantha's parenting in the sense we were talking about when we were talking about the episode Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
About how she's like letting Neelix be the babysitter.
I would never let Neelix be my child's babysitter.
Not without supervision.
No, like he's like the man child. Like it's like when you put the inmates in charge of the asylum, essentially.
Who of the crew would you choose as a babysitter?
Tuvok.
Okay.
You see, out of everyone,
mm-hmm.
he kind of seems the most responsible. Not the doctor.
He has kids.
Yeah, he has kids. Not the doctor.
What about Kes when she was around?
She doesn't have any experience with children, you know?
But I mean, when you're young, you're babysat by grade 12 students or whatever.
Yeah, Kes seems nurturing enough.
Yeah.
Kim seems too much of a doofus. Tom Paris, too much of a bad boy.
Yeah.
You know, Chakotay would be staring at the mirror the whole time.
The kids would be asleep listening to Doc.
Yeah, no, maybe we put Chakotay in charge just so the kids go to bed right away.
Yeah.
Okay. Alrighty, sir.
Okay, well, let's move into Enterprise,
yeah.
which to round us out here.
I think the big one here, though, would be the relationship to Paul has with her mother.
That's
here,
the
essentially,
big one.
Forces her to get into this marriage.
Yes.
With Koss, and Koss is actually not such a bad guy.
No, and yeah. even her mother's not that bad.
No,
because her mother initially doesn't like Trip, but then her
can
mother,
you blame her?
Well, keeps talking about catfish. You know, it's like,
pecan pie.
Yeah, but she does come.
My
around.
Dad's sister in Florida.
She does come around to Trip and is like pushing him to confess his feelings to T'Pol. Yeah. So I think T'Pol's mom is actually kind of cool. She has her own ideas for how she'd like her daughter to turn out, but she's flexible, which is something you can't say for a lot of Vulcans.
But wasn't she one of the what were they called, like Serenite or Serachites or something?
Serenites,
like
yeah.
Serenites, yeah. She was a Serenite, so it kind of makes sense that she'd be a little bit more freewheeling compared to some of those other Vulcans. So,
right.
With her, well, how tortured is T'Pol to find out that her mother's no longer with us, though?
I don't know if she's that tortured.
No.
T'Pol is such a, is written as aloof a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I guess as a Vulcan, but I don't know. It didn't feel like there was a lot of lingering feelings about that relationship going forward.
No, certainly not going forward.
Yeah.
I think as soon as the divorce is complete,
yeah.
What does T'Pol really have to resent her mother
no.
against, you know?
But they don't even seem that close either. It's kind of like it's a functional relationship, but it's not really... I don't know.
What, T'Pol and Koss or T'Pol?
Sorry, T'Pol and her mother.
Yeah. You know, I definitely not the same dynamic as you get with Spock and Sarek.
No.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I guess they just didn't want to rip that off.
Right. But, now, Cam, now my favorite Enterprise mother-daughter relationship, Hoshi.
With the question mark mother?
Yeah.
She was close to her grandmother, though. We know that.
There you go. Actually, no. What do you think about Reed and his mom? Well, he doesn't apparently know anything that he... has going on in his life.
You ask my mom what my favorite food is, she can tell you in a second.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty sad that his mother can't even tell, like, Archer what he likes. But, you know, we find out that neither the mother or the father, you know, Reed hasn't spoken to either of them in years. What's with all these people either having parents that died when they were young or just, like, parents they don't talk to?
I think it's an easy way for the writers to say, hey, this person has conflict within their lives. And it seems like lazy writing to me.
But like Starfleet is a pretty respectable operation. It's not like they went to become mercenaries or something. You know what I mean?
It's like, yeah, they should be well-adjusted people that can all, you know, pass the psych exam with flying colors. But they all seem to have like issues with their family.
I mean, how many people do you think out there right now in the world on like science, science trips? Or like, I don't talk to my parents, man. I wanted to go on this science expedition, and it was all downhill after that.
Hey, Antarctica, man. It could happen.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I guess let's close out strong with Mayweather.
Is it even worth mentioning?
It's why you can say that his mother was basically the peacemaker in the family because Mayweather did not get along with his father or his brother because they wanted him to be on a garbage scow.
Yeah.
What was it? Yeah.
Going at like warp one, that sounds fun.
They never found anything for that Mayweather character to do.
I really do feel bad for Anthony Montgomery because we've seen him at conventions. He's a very engaging guy. You can understand why he, you know, nailed the audition and was hired for the role. But why did they never give him anything interesting to do?
I don't know. Well, they kind of did. Well, I shouldn't say interesting, but they gave him things to do in the first season or so with, you know, Horizon and Favorite Son and stuff. But those episodes were such dead zones of entertainment that it's like, I'm sure they were just like, let's just not do this anymore.
I've said this before, but go watch In a Mirror Darkly and we see Mirror Universe Mayweather.
Yeah.
And Mirror Mayweather is fun and fantastic and a ball of charisma. Like they need I wish they maybe made him more dangerous or give him more of an edge or like something where the would call back to that Mirror Universe side of him that I found so intriguing.
I even kind of like him in the Demons Terra Prime two-parter, where he has the relationship with that woman who's like a journalist, I think, but she's actually like an undercover operative. I actually like that. That was actually some interesting character building where Anthony Montgomery got to show a little bit of charisma.
Right.
You know, the family drama stuff. I, you know, as we close out this episode, the future of Star Trek how much more family drama do we want to see?
I don't want to see any more. Like, we've had 700 episodes of this.
Yeah.
Let's find conflict within the characters from other facets of their lives.
Yeah.
That's what I have to say. I don't need any more people that have estranged parents.
Wouldn't it be more hopeful for the future if we had more, like, well-adjusted family situations?
Yeah.
Even if it's single parents. I don't care what the, care what the organization of the family is, but just, like, have, like, kids turning out, like, you know, I did have a good upbringing.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, you know, you look at, like, the TNG crew or whatever, their parents are either dead or miserable. You know, yeah. It's like...
Or question marks.
Or question marks. Yeah. You know, Voyager, they apparently didn't even have mothers.
No.
Half of them. But, you know, it's just like... Like, really? Is this... Do we have to keep falling back on this trope? It's time to move forward, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Tyler, what is the address?
Yeah, go to facebook.com/subspacepod. That is facebook.com/subspacepod. Or else just search Subspace Transmissions in Facebook. If you enjoy listening to the show, a free show, by the way, please just follow us on Facebook. You also get access to exclusive content that is not available through subscribing to us here on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever podcast machine you're using here. But that's all we ask.
Cool. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we'll be looking a little closer at the various faces of Brent Spiner, all the various roles that this very talented actor has performed, not just Data, but... They give this guy numerous situations to really show his acting chops.
He's the Lon Chaney of Star Trek. Or maybe just the Lon Chaney Jr. I'm not really sure.
Who's Lon Chaney?
Lon Chaney, he was the Man of a Thousand Faces. He was the Phantom of the Opera. He was the Hunchback of Notre Dame. And then his son played the Wolfman and like Frankenstein. It was a family tradition.
Well, there you go.
And let's see if, Brent Spiner playing several members of his family on Star Trek pays off just as well. I'm actually looking forward to this one.
Yeah, this will be fun.
Fun episodes to talk about and some interesting offshoot episodes that I'm sure have been looking for reasons to talk about for a while now.
Yes.
So don't miss that one. I think it's going to be something else.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay, you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in very happy Mother's Day to all you mothers out there. Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in Naomi Wildman has the best mother ever. Neelix!
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.